Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please.
Morning.
Case number 08-3052, United States of America versus Lloyd Seibles, appellant. Mr. Pascal for the appellant, Ms. Nyland for the appellee.
Please, the court. John Pascal on behalf of the appellant, Lloyd Seibles.
Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is a case where my client filed a motion back in October 19th of 2004 to reconsider the district court's order denying his earlier motion to withdraw the guilty, his guilty plea. That order, that motion was denied without the benefit of an evidentiary hearing. In that motion, he alleged several things, that he had a viable defense, that he did not truly understand the terms of the plea agreement, especially the sentencing issue, whether or not pleading guilty would have resulted in a more favorable sentence than if he had gone to trial. But I think the key issue here is his allegation of ineffective assistance, which I believe can only have been properly dealt with by the district court after it had an evidentiary hearing and heard under oath testimony from my client and his defense attorney as to what went into the decision to plead guilty. I think that would encompass far more than just the sentencing ramifications. When you plead guilty, the case should first have been thoroughly investigated by a defense counsel. The government's case and evidence should have been evaluated and explained to the defendant. Any viable defenses should have been gone over, or all defenses should have gone over.
What viable defense is it he is supposed to have?
Well, he's saying he lacked the sufficient intent, that the government had insufficient evidence, that they didn't.
So the whole line of defense is the sufficiency of the evidence defense, right?
Well, he's alleging now he had a defense and that...
The only defense he's alleging, the only claim of viable defense is sufficiency of evidence, correct?
Yes.
So is that not something that could be raised by every defendant in every case? Aren't you writing that requirement out of the plea set aside jurisprudence if we say that's sufficient to make out the viable defense claim?
Well, there should be some evidence that there was a viable defense. My client's saying that he had insufficient, he didn't have the specific intent for conspiracy. The government didn't have any direct evidence that he was.
Well, normally you don't have direct evidence of intent. You operate on the basis that people intend the natural consequences of their actions. That we tell juries, or we did when I was instructing juries.
Yes, we had a trial. Yes, we still done, Your Honor. But my client is I think the issue is what preparation did his defense counsel provide him? What advice?
Well, that's not the issue that I'm currently asking about. I was asking about viable defense.
Viable, yes.
Yeah. You can move on. I guess we've exhausted that, so you can move on.
I think what was needed in this case was an evidentiary hearing where the defense counsel and the defendant, which would, of course, waive attorney-client privilege, could have testified under oath of what went on prior to the guilty plea. My client apparently, it's from the record, it seems that he clearly did not understand the sentencing issue, what he was exposing himself to.
Where in the record do you find evidence of this confusion?
Well, in his motions that he filed, that he seems to think, in his counsels he had that filed his motions for him, that he would have been might as well have rolled the dice on a trial. He didn't gain anything by pleading guilty. And whether that's true or not, he seemed to think that. So that indicates that his trial counsel did not properly brief him on the plea offer.
But he had a lengthy Rule 11 colloquy.
Yeah.
He talked about the plea. He signed the plea agreement.
Well, I think a lot of times with these Rule 11s, defendants want, if they want the plea, they know what answers to give. And it's a lot of yes or no answers.
So is that the Rule 11 colloquy is just meaningless then?
No, Your Honor, it's not meaningless. It's in this case, apparently after the guilty plea and then the sentence, my client was...
Do you think it matters that he didn't have this change of heart for more than 2 years?
I think it makes the argument a little more difficult, Your Honor. However, he did have time to think about it, and he's come to the conclusion that he was not properly represented prior to the guilty plea. And I think that would have, if an evidentiary hearing would have provided the district court with far more evidence, the court would have been able to have listened to and seen both defense counsel and the appellant.
What's the standard we should use in deciding whether there has to be an evidentiary hearing?
I think almost whenever ineffective assistance of counsel is raised, it should be held.
Should it be held in the context of the withdrawal of the guilty plea, or should it be held in a post-conviction relief context?
Well, anything, Your Honor, I think that involves attorney-client privilege that where it's not going to show up in the record unless there is a hearing.
That's not what I asked you, was
it? No, it wasn't, Your Honor.
I said, should that be in the context of the withdrawal of a guilty plea, or should it be in a post-conviction relief context?
I think it should be in both.
2255 or whatever the number is.
It should be in both, Your Honor.
It should be in both? He should have two bites at that apple?
Well, if there was a second set of... if he had more representation following the guilty plea.
So you'd say everybody that's in prison right now who pleaded guilty could come in and say, I didn't get good enough advice, and they get an evidentiary hearing?
If they filed, I doubt that everybody would do that, Your Honor. But
so all they have to do is file, and they'll get it. And you really doubt that?
If they have a, yeah. Certainly if they allege ineffective assistance of counsel.
Okay.
So your principal suggestion is he's claiming he got nothing from the plea agreement and might just well go into trial. That's not correct.
Well, that's what he's alleging.
But that's not correct, right?
Objectively, it may not be. But
you have what you have, Representative.
Yeah.
I understand that. We're respectful of that. But that's all you can assert, is that he thinks he really got nothing from the plea agreement, which is just flat wrong. But that's the most you can come up with in this situation on behalf of him, right?
Based on the record, Your Honor, I don't think I can say otherwise.
All right. I'm not going to squeeze your head in the situation in which you find yourself. You know, you have what you have to work with, and that's all that's there. But I just wanted to be sure that that's all you're presenting. That's all you can find to present.
That's all I can find, Your Honor. I've read the record many times, and
all right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We need to hear her. Mm-hmm. We need to hear her. Counsel, we'll take your argument on the briefs.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pascal, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this case, and the court thanks you for your assistance.
Thank
you. Call the next case.
Case number 08-5458, Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, Inc., et al., Appellants versus Food and Drug Administration, et al. Mr. Joseph for the appellant, Ms. Lyons for the appellees.
Good morning, Mr. Joseph.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Larry Joseph for the four appellants, plaintiff appellants. The district judge dismissed for lack of standing and for failure to exhaust administrative remedies. We contested that in a Rule 58E motion. 59E, I'm sorry. And we also requested merits relief under Rule 52C. The pleading support, we argue, standing on all of the claims, the affidavit that was submitted, I believe, would support standing primarily on the competitive injury, if on the merits, that is. So there's a different level of proof as to the different standing claims. The district judge indicated that we could not rest on competitive injury. We had to show lost revenue. I believe that's contrary to several cases in this jurisdiction.
What's the closest case you have to this one in which we've held a competitive injury to be to confer standing?
Well, there's we cited four of them. I think Shays versus FEC. There's an American Gas.
Were any of those, give me the parallel that you see between the best case you have and this one.
You have an entrant into a market that wasn't theretofore allowed.
What's your defined market here?
The defined market is providing access to this pill at one level. If you consider it, that would be considering.
And the doctors are not selling the pill, right?
They're providing, they're providing access.
Doctors are not selling the pill.
Correct. Right? They you have to come visit in the old day before the action. Mm-hmm. You had to go to the doctor to get permission, essentially, and that visit would generate revenue.
And but they can still go to the doctor. The patient can still go to the doctor if she chooses, right?
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
But
so it's a third party actor between the government regulation and the putative competition. Even if we define the market so as to include both the physician and the...
Yes, but it's not an unfettered third-party actor, because the third-party actor couldn't, without the administrative action, accomplish what you're suggesting, what the district court suggests.
She can now. She can,
she can now, but she couldn't before the administrative action.
She'll go to the doctor.
She can still go to the doctor. The point
the
is...
The government regulation is not preventing her from using your doctor's services, right?
Absolutely not. It's allowing her, and that's enough under the...
Under what is that enough? That's where I'm trying to get to. Well, what case do you have that is genuinely parallel to this one?
Well, we're moving away from competition and into the fact that it's unlawful competition. I forget the name of the case escapes me, but it's Telephone Data Systems is part of the name. The notion that when an agency action authorizes something that was theretofore illegal... That solved
head-on competition in that case.
What's that?
Wasn't that head-on competition in that case?
I'm not certain. I'd have to check that. But the point stands whether it's a competition or not. That when
no, the point doesn't.
Okay, okay, I'm sorry.
No, your whole point was that it's competitive.
Point is competitive standing. You either have a market in which there's
right.
an adverse effect on competition or not.
Okay, and I would submit—I didn't mean to interrupt. I would submit that that is only relevant if you want to decide whether we have merit standing, because we also allege informational standing.
Yeah, but informational standing, has that ever been granted with respect to a statute that did not directly speak to the subject of requiring the release of information?
The Federal Advisory Committee Act does not have a express requirement for the release of information.
That's the whole purpose of the Federal Advisory Committee Act, isn't it?
Well, I mean, one could argue that the whole purpose of the labeling.
FEC, that's the statutes that have been used for informational standing, aren't they? And those are the ones that directly create a right to information, right?
As indeed do the labeling requirements of the FFDCA. If you're
There's
talking
not anything here about labeling requirements. You're not attacking the any information that the government is or is not providing on the label.
Oh, we absolutely are. I mean, the label says RX OTC, RX prescription, OTC over the
right.
counter.
And that's not
the statute prohibits that.
That's not withheld from anybody, is it?
What's that?
That information is not withheld from anybody, is it?
The pharmacist.
Right there on the label, right?
Right, and we say that it shouldn't be. The pharmacist, the
right,
the
so that is about as far from the informational standing cases. It wouldn't be more than 180 degrees because you can't get more than 180 degrees.
Okay. Well,
if you're going to get standing, you're going to have to get it in competitive standing, aren't you? I don't see how you, there's no informational standing case close to this, is there?
Well, first of all, there's a PREA 2007, which requires publishing on the internet, which is, we argue, informational. Before we go there, if I could quickly, I'm sorry. The Humphrey Durham amendments in 1951 were created expressly to give pharmacists an understanding of what they could sell mm-hmm. and couldn't sell over the counter. So yeah. It is informational in the most core. This is the dead.
But informational standing goes to the withholding of information. And you're not alleging here, you're not seeking information in this case. You're not saying court compel them to release this information they're withholding from us, which they're required to turn over by the statute, are you? That's not what you're asking for.
I guess in the RxOTC, well, in the case of pre-2007, we are. In the case of...
You're asking the court to enter an order turning over information to you?
In the case of...
What information is it you're asking to be turned over to you?
If this decision were to be vacated and were to be sent back to the agency, it would then fit within the timing time savings clause of PREA 2007. It would be
did you hear my question?
You're not answering this.
Well, I'm getting there. I'm sorry.
My question was, if you have informational standing, what information is it you're seeking to have the government compelled to release to you?
Okay, if it gets remanded, then they would have to provide the summaries of the data that were submitted under PREA 2007 to show that this was or wasn't safe for pediatric populations.
The relief you're seeking is the release of information. Is that correct? Is that the relief you're seeking here?
We're seeking.
I thought you were seeking to enjoin the over-the-counter sale of the morning-after pill.
We're seeking to vacate the current approval, which we say is unlawful. If that happens,
you have a standing basis in order to be able to do that. You're talking about if you can win on that, there may be consequences that have to do with information. But we need to know how you have standing achieve what you want in the first place. The information standing certainly doesn't support it. That's not what you're asking for. You're asking to block the award that was given to the drug company in a separate adjudication. And fail to exhaust in the meanwhile.
Oh, should we go into exhaustion?
We're not going to get there if you can't tell us standing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, we allege that we want the information that they would have to provide if we were remanded, and we contest the safety. I suppose we should keep.
Let me just make sure I understand. I'm not following the information standing arguments. I didn't in the brief, and I don't now. What's your best case on competitor standing? What's the one that you think is analogous?
Well, market entrance into a field.
What's your best precedent?
American Gas, I don't recall the name.
Involving direct competitors.
Okay, yes. And then on exhaustion, we did. First of all, the record's not before this court because FDA wouldn't provide it below.
You haven't exhausted. You came directly into court.
Well, no, we submitted these arguments. You
submitted a set of arguments in connection with a notice of proposed rulemaking that has nothing to do with your public citizen claim under their regulations. It had nothing to do with this case.
But the commissioner testified to Congress that they considered the comments from the advance notice of proposed rulemaking.
But the reason you have this public citizen thing is people can come in and say that the commission, the agency, look, we now see what you've done or failed to do. And here's the way, in light of all of the history preceding it, here's the argument we want to make, either to get you not to do what you're about to do, or to do something new, or whatever. You haven't done that.
We submitted them. They considered them. The record would show that. And in any event, as to counts 2, 4, and 6.
You absolutely have not initiated a public citizen.
A petition, you mean? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about a case. Well, the application, SNDA itself is a petition. Under the definitions, and we participated in that, we would argue.
You weren't in that adjudication.
Fair enough, but even if that were true.
Fair enough, that's critical. You've so conflated this, you couldn't appeal from someone else's adjudication. That was an adjudication between the agency and a private drug company. And the disposition there was as to them. You couldn't appeal that. He obviously knew that. You had no right to appeal that. But you have this provision in the agency regs which says, as to anything, you can come in with a public citizen complaint or claim and pursue it. You have to exhaust it before you go to court.
exhaustion does not apply if it would be futile. And as to counts 2, 4, 6, and 8, they have...
You argued futility in the district court.
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
Okay. Where do I find that?
Beg your pardon? In our 52C motion, our post-judgment motion.
And it's futile, you say, because you participated in a notice of...
No, I'm sorry. They prejudged the issue. They moved under 12B6 on the merits on 2, 4, 6, and 8. Because exhaustion is a count-by-count thing. The question is, did they in fact consider it? The question isn't whether we appeared below. The NRDC versus EPA case is an en banc decision of this court, which, of course, you can't reverse, that says the question is whether, not whether we participated, but whether they in fact considered the issues. And I don't know how we can know that.
That's a different issue. You have to exhaust.
I'm not following.
NRDC did not, in that en banc decision, exhaust. They didn't participate. The question was whether the agency in fact considered the issues. That's all the common law exhaustion that's required. And in any event.
No, was that in connection with, I'm not remembering the facts.
I think was
that
preservation of issue, wasn't it? Which case is that?
NRDC versus EPA.
What was the preceding proceeding that was in that case? Was that a rulemaking?
Yes.
Yeah, and someone else had raised the question.
That's a rulemaking.
Someone else had raised the question. And the agency had considered it.
And so participation.
That's not this case.
That was not an adjudication at all. That was a rulemaking.
That was correct.
Right?
This is an adjudication that you were not a party to. You couldn't have been a party to it. The commission did what it did in that case. You now have the right under a regulation that commission puts in place to file a citizen complaint. You didn't do it. You didn't do it. You didn't raise whatever your concerns were about that adjudication, which is what you're concerned about, and give the commission a shot at it. And you certainly can't say that our notice, the comments that we gave in a preceding notice of rulemaking, which was withdrawn, should serve to satisfy the exhaustion requirement with respect to your challenge to an adjudication that you were not a party to in a public citizen suit.
Well, it didn't.
That makes no sense. It's like, yeah. I'm reading this and I'm like, where does this all come from?
Yeah. It wasn't preceding. It was in the middle of the SNDA we're challenging, and it arose specifically because of the SNDA we're challenging, and the commissioner testified to Congress that they considered the comments.
Whatever it is, you can appeal from the supplemental proceeding. That was an adjudication in which you didn't participate.
Well, in NRDC, again, there was a non-participant that was allowed
to appeal. Rulemaking.
That was a rulemaking. Well,
it's a whole, our jurisprudence operates entirely differently when you've got an adjudication. You can't appeal from someone else's adjudication. It wasn't your adjudication. You can pursue this agency procedure and make it your case. But if you want to have your case as opposed to their adjudication, you have to exhaust.
That is not a statutory requirement. It's they're only in their regulations, and their regulations don't comply with Section 704.
Well, how else do you have a cause of action?
Beg your pardon?
How else do you have a cause of action?
Under the Administrative Procedure Act.
What in the Administrative? You have to find a cause of action. 702 doesn't give you a cause of action. It says you have a right of review, but you have to find it somewhere. What's the cause of action?
1331.
The cause of action here is you're pointing to, I looked at your brief again, and you understood this because you didn't cite 702. Your cause of action is the regulation, which says you have a public citizen suit right, and you're pursuing it, right?
Well, we also have ultra-virus judicial review. There's any number of causes of action.
Okay, let's forget the ultra-virus for a minute, on which you have a very weak claim. Your principal claim, and your brief indicates it, is you're using the agency regulation, which says, you cited.
That's not our principal claim. Our principal claim is a federal question jurisdiction.
That's not a claim.
Federal question jurisdiction is jurisdiction. It's not a claim.
Fair enough.
So your claim, I because this was so convoluted, I went to your brief to make sure I understood it. Many times. It is the agency regulation on which you're resting. 1331 is just your way of jurisdictionally getting
Which regulation
to get
is that?
Court.
The judicial review regulations in Part 10?
Yes.
Oh. Well, I mean, I think
yes,
we do assert.
Yes, you absolutely assert it. Do I have to point you to your brief?
That's a rebuttal to the argument that we didn't comply with the regulations. We do have a cause of action under the Administrative Procedure Act.
Where? What? For what?
For an agency action outside of
706?
Yes.
Okay. Does 704 say you have to exhaust if there's an exhaustion requirement
Only, well, first of all, there's not a statutory exhaustion requirement.
Doesn't have to be a statutory exhaustion.
If it's a regulatory requirement, it has to hold the thing in abeyance.
No, there's nothing to hold. That's where your argument's totally confused. There's nothing to hold in abeyance. The prior adjudication is not your action. They don't have to hold someone else's adjudication results in abeyance while you pursue a separate cause of action under the APA. Who said that? There's no such rule.
Well, okay, then you've
completely misread Darby. You've completely misread 704. They don't have to hold that in abeyance. You're trying to come in on an APA claim on your own. You can't appeal from the adjudication. This is on your own. Okay. They don't have to hold anything in abeyance. If you're trying to come in on an APA claim and there's an exhaustion requirement, you must exhaust.
Even if it's regulatory and there's
Darby was the so-called common law exhaustion requirement, wasn't it? There was not even a regulatory exhaustion requirement in Darby, was there? And where this court said that you had to.
I don't know the answer to that. That's
agency,
and got it wrong.
If the agency or a statute requires exhaustion, unless you meet one of the exceptions to it and you're trying to argue futility, that's a different argument. If there is an exhaustion requirement under Darby, you must exhaust. And you're trying to come in under the APA. That's all. The prior adjudication is not your case. You can't appeal from that. So you can't kind of weave that in as if to say, well, they have to hold that in abeyance. No.
Well, we could have appealed the premature termination of the AMPRM if
that's
there
right.
had that.
Maybe you could have, but you didn't.
But their regulations don't.
But you didn't.
Well, this case does that.
No, this case does not do that. That's not your cause of action in this case.
It's certainly a viable cause of action if you hold the way.
I don't know whether it's viable or not. It's not this cause of action. You know what? We really prepare these things carefully, and we do look at what you say. That's not what you said.
There are cases from this court where if someone has a viable cause of action, you would remand for the consideration of that, even though it wasn't in the pleadings.
We try and figure it out and say, well, wait, what? We're going to send it back. Why don't you try this one?
Well, I'm telling you. I mean, I'm not asking you to make it up. I'm asking you to say that there is other relief that you could provide. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the appellee.
They were not a party to the prior adjudication, right?
They were not a party to any adjudication, right. Your Honor.
All right. I just want to make sure I had that right, because that's where the arguments got confused. Not your arguments. That's where the presentation got very confusing. So we're...
Okay. If you'd like, I'll clarify that point.
No, you don't have to clarify it. I got it. Okay. You have to clarify it for me. I've got it.
Okay. I'd like to start at the beginning then with, may it please the court.
We're pleased. Go ahead.
Excellent. The two organizations of the four who are appellants before this court, only two of them have members, so two of them are knocked out right at the beginning with regard to standing. The two that actually have members, which are the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons and the Safe Drugs for Women, both lack constitutional and prudential standing to challenge the decision to allow dual prescription and over-the-counter distribution of Plan B.
Why isn't competitive standing good enough?
Competitive standing isn't good enough because, interestingly enough, the competition that the plaintiffs cite or the appellants rely on in this court relates to competition between and among themselves. The physicians and the pharmacists claim that they're in competition with each other in a way that they weren't before the over-the-counter distribution was allowed for women over the age of 18 or over.
Is that your best argument? Because if some members of an organization have standing and it's within the core purpose of the organization, you could have organizational standing.
More is required than that, Your Honor. It's not. That might...
That's what I'm asking you, don't...
Yeah. No, this is not anything like, as your questions to my counterpart suggested, this is not anything like a direct competitor place, and this is not a market entrant situation. The competition that's allowed here is in the market, I suppose, for services by a doctor to a woman. Mm-hmm. And this a woman is now able to, but nothing in the statute precludes a woman from seeking medical advice from her doctor for any reason, including to obtain emergency contraceptives. So the market is not changed meaningfully by the government's decision here to allow dual over-the-counter and prescription access to a drug. The purpose of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is to allow access to safe and effective drugs with as little burden on the pharmacists, the women, and the manufacturers as possible to make, you know, good drugs available as easily as it is safe to do so. And the decision itself doesn't really alter anything about that situation. So this is not a competitive kind of environment. The government's activity has no real impact on competition.
At least at the prudential stage of standing analysis, this is not what that regulation is protecting.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's another way of saying perhaps that the physicians and the pharmacists are not within the zone of interest of the of the statute. The notion that appellants have relied on is that the government's decision made the sales over the counter unlawful, and that is what introduces the competitive standing sort of injury. Obviously, if you went past the injury component of the standing analysis and you went to causation and redressability, the decision they address would not, even if reversed, would not take Plan B off the market. It would still be available. Mm-hmm. So let's see. That's the competitive standing. You didn't spend very much time on the informational standing. And the district court's alternative holding that the organizations had failed to exhaust, Judge Edwards, you are entirely correct that they did not participate in the informal adjudication that resulted in the decision.
Did I express a view on this?
I wouldn't presume to suggest that.
Heaven forbid.
It is true that the supplemental new drug application that was approved in 2006 is a proceeding between the agency and the manufacturer only, and that is that's the purpose.
Just as a matter of curiosity.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because it's not before us. You think under our normal jurisprudence they could have challenged your withdrawal of the rulemaking?
Hmm.
Interesting question.
That is an interesting question that had not occurred to me until you were talking about it with
certainly
Mr. Joseph.
Certainly, petition for rulemaking
yep.
with a heightened standard of review under the APA. So I suppose under that theory you could say we're petitioning for rulemaking and
yeah.
I don't understand why they withdrew. Now you get the benefit of a very heightened or very stringent standard of review.
I think they would be under the burden of having to show that there was a statute that required the rulemaking. And I'm not sure that in this context there is a statute that requires a rulemaking in that context.
The standard is so high, I'm not entirely sure what they have to. They would. That is one way they could do it. There may be other ways, but
yes,
yeah.
Perhaps.
But in any event, that's not what they've done here.
That's correct. The district court, you know, clearly did not abuse its discretion in denying any of the post March 2008 motions that appellants filed. I don't seem to sense any discomfort with that decision. If there are no further questions, right. We'll submit and ask that this court affirm the decision
none.
Below.
Thank you, counsel. I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal, if you want it.
Absolutely. The notion that there's no statute that requires a rulemaking, we say that 503B1 and B3 require a rulemaking. So, I mean, this is a context that needed to be a rulemaking, and they didn't conduct it. So I don't understand why we can't challenge
you
that.
Ask for a rulemaking. You haven't asked for a rulemaking yet, have you?
Okay. On the prudential issue, this is a statutory demarcation case, so the zone of interest collapses for suitable challengers.
I have no idea what that meant.
The Honeywell and I forget the other case, but when you're merely enforcing a statutory requirement rather than a hazardous waste company wanting to have things more clean so that they get more business, that when you're trying to enforce a clearly defined suitable statutory demarcation like SATO, Scheduled Airline transit office or something like that, and Honeywell, they're both in our brief, that allows a suitable, any person essentially to be a suitable challenger if all they're trying to do is what the statute requires, which again is a rulemaking here. I think.
Okay, your time is up.
Case number 07-1533 et al. Florida Gas Transmission Company Petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Stoljic for Petitioner, Florida Gas Transmission Company, LLC. Ms. Tomalty for Petitioner, Florida Power and Light Company. And Ms. Banta for the respondent.
We'll hear from Florida Gas. Morning, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I begin?
You certainly may. We've been waiting for quite some time, actually.
May it please the Court, my name is Steve Stoljic, and I represent Florida Gas Transmission Company, also called FGT. FGT's issue involves the Commission's imposition of new gas quality standards on gas from FGT's Western Division. The Commission imposed such standards at the Alabama-Florida state line, which is the location where the Western Division gas is transported on FGT's main line from the Western Division into the market area. Such location is shown on a map that was contained in Appendix 1 to FGT's initial brief. FGT's Western Division is to the west of the Alabama-Florida state line, and FGT's market area is to the east of that line, which is basically the state of Florida. FGT and the Commission are in agreement on a number of points. First, FGT is in agreement that the Commission made the express finding that there is no evidence of any problems with Western Division gas, regardless of whether it is delivered in the Western Division or in the market area. Second, FGT is in agreement that the Commission itself concluded that because there was no evidence of any problem with Western Division gas anywhere on FGT's system, there was no basis for a finding that the current gas quality standards for Western Division gas are unjust and unreasonable under Section 5 of the Natural Gas Act. Third, FGT is in agreement that under Section 5, the Commission must first find that existing standards are unjust and unreasonable and then establish the just and reasonable standards that would apply prospectively. The Commission violated Section 5 because it contradicted its own findings. Given their express finding of no problem with Western Division gas anywhere on FGT's system, and its finding that there was no basis for any action under Section 5, the Commission, nonetheless, contrary to its own findings, established new standards for Western Division gas, and that constituted a violation of the statutory requirements under Section 5. The Commission attempts to avoid its violation of Section 5 by claiming that it is simply imposing the same standards on all gas entering the market area. The problem with the Commission's argument is that it made very different findings for Western Division gas than for other gas that is received at receipt points in the market area. The Commission found that there were no problems with Western Division gas anywhere on FGT's system, including when the gas is delivered in the market area. Based on this lack of evidence, they found there was no basis for Section 5 action. The same Western Division gas for which the Commission found no problem doesn't suddenly require new standards just because it passes a state line. In contrast, the Commission made very different findings for gas received in the market area. And under those findings, it had the necessary basis for action under Section 5 to oppose new gas quality standards. Unlike Western Division Gas, the Commission found that LNG could create problems in FGT's market area. And unlike Western Division Gas, the Commission found that FGT's existing quality standards were not sufficient to address LNG received at receipt points in the market area. And then unlike Western Division Gas, the Commission also found that FGT's existing standards were unjust and unreasonable under Section 5. As this Court has repeatedly found, the Commission must comply with the statutory requirements of NGA Section 5 when imposing new tariff standards. The Commission did not do so here when it imposed new standards on Western Division Gas. Despite its own findings, there was no basis for action under Section 5.
And what your petition is about is the Western Division Gas.
Right.
Not gas that comes in. You're not attacking anything with respect to gas that comes in other receipt points?
Or? Yeah, at the receipt points in the market area. In fact, we're in agreement with the Commission on the other two issues on appeal in this case. Our second issue is the Commission irrationally imposed new gas quality standards on Western Division Gas because they imposed them in the middle of FGT's pipeline. The industry standard location for gas quality standards is at a receipt point because that's where a change of custody occurs. The party delivering the gas delivers the gas at that point, and the pipeline receiving the gas receives gas at that point. If the gas fails to meet the quality standards, then the pipeline can refuse receipt of the gas. It is this logical nexus between the gas quality standards and the control of non-compliant gas that underlies the Commission's policy or its precedent for approving gas quality standards at receipt points. The Commission's requirement to apply gas quality standards on a commingled gas stream in the middle of a pipeline is therefore totally illogical. In the middle of a pipeline, there is no change in custody, there's no ability to identify the party responsible for the non-conforming gas, and it is not possible to refuse the non-conforming gas or shut it out. Thus, there's no rational basis for the Commission to impose gas quality standards in the middle of a pipeline. FGT cannot control the quality of gas after it enters the pipeline. It can only do so before. In order to enforce the quality standards imposed by the Commission, FGT imposed a control mechanism that would apply at Western Division receipt points, the only location where FGT can prevent non-compliant gas from entering its system. FGT has no ability to enforce quality standards at the state border because the gas has already entered FGT's pipeline at that point.
Not sure how the test would take place at that point away from receipt points at the state line. Are you supposed to drill a hole in the pipe there to create somewhere to test from, or what?
To test the gas?
Yeah.
It's actually, I think, Station 12 where they have the measurement facilities that can measure the different quality aspects of the gas. So you can measure it, but you just can't do anything about it. The Commission failed to provide a rational basis for rejection of FGT's control mechanism. The end result is the Commission has irrationally imposed new standards on Western Division Gas, but has provided no mechanism to enable FGT to refuse receipt of Western Division Gas that fails to meet such standards. In summary, the Commission's imposition of new quality standards on Western Division Gas violates Section 5 of the Natural Gas Act and has no rational basis.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the other petitioner.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Sarah Tomalty, and I represent Petitioner Florida Power and Light Company. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The issue I'd like to address first is FERC's authority to adopt a cost allocation methodology for end users' mitigation costs. FERC said the issue of compensation for mitigation costs from the interruption of LNG was within the scope of this proceeding. FERC then reversed course and said they had no jurisdictional authority to address the adverse cost impacts on FPL and other end users.
What is their jurisdictional authority for the relief you want?
FERC has several judicial authorities to protect the public interest from the introduction of LNG. For example, FERC has authority under Section 3, 4, 5, and 7 to protect the public interest from the effects of LNG.
By doing what under those sections? What is their authority given under those sections?
Under Section 4, the Commission has authority over the rates, terms, and conditions of service on pipelines.
How does that give them jurisdiction to do what you want here?
This Court and the Supreme Court have both ruled that FERC has authority to act and to take into account non-jurisdictional gas products when acting pursuant to Natural Gas Section 4. For example, the Public Utility Commission.
What's the relief you want here?
What the relief we would like is for you to overturn the FERC and deem that it does have authority to address end users' mitigation costs and to deem.
All right, once you say once they address it, what is it you want them to do about it?
We had argued on rehearing several different options for FERC here. One is they have authority over, well, FERC's argument is that they don't have authority over the product, the purchase and sale of LNG, therefore they don't have authority over LNG suppliers. We had suggested that FERC has multiple areas of authority in this proceeding.
And the relief you want them to employ is?
Is to review our mitigation costs and to adopt a methodology.
Having reviewed it, what is it you want them to do?
To adopt a methodology to allocate those costs to the responsible parties. FERC never got to the issue of who those responsible parties should be because it deemed.
They're not going to get to the issue unless you say who it is that you think you're talking about.
We had
what it is you want them to do about it.
Sure. We had argued for several different options. On rehearing, we had argued that either FGT, pursuant to its FERC Section 5 authority in the proceeding, could be responsible for those costs and they could be.
The cost being the mitigation by end users?
Yes. And they could
do
be.
Do you have any place where we've held they did have authority to do something like that?
Sure. FERC in the Public Utility Commission of the State of Colorado the D.C. Circuit indicated that FERC may take into account non-jurisdictional activities. In this case, it was.
Take into account is not going to get you here. Tell me about a relief like this that the FERC has granted and we felt
they
could do it.
In opinion number 101, I have two cases actually. Opinion number 101, which is a Columbia Gas proceeding, FERC looked at the introduction of LNG from the Cove Point facility and the impact it would have on Washington Gas Light and BG&E's systems, and it specifically indicated that those costs should be borne by those parties responsible for bringing the LNG to those end users. In addition, FERC recently.
Was that end user cost in that case?
Those were both end user costs. In addition, FERC indicated that not only the end user's costs could be allocated to the responsible parties. In this case, it was the developer of the project as well as the pipeline that was shipping the gas, but also indicated that. End-use entities behind the LDC City Gate could allocate those costs to the upstream entities to the extent that the State Commission allowed them to pass those through to their customers.
Has the State Commission done anything here?
The State Commission has said nothing here.
So that's not a parallel case, is it?
No, that's not part of the basis of the Commission's ruling. And as I mentioned, FERC has several different authorities under Section 4, 5, 7, and 3 in this proceeding. FERC erred with respect to three errors in stating that its only relevant jurisdiction in this proceeding was with respect to the rates, terms, and conditions of FGT's interstate transportation system. First, it ignored the fact that this proceeding was brought under Section 5 of the Natural Gas Act, which gives FERC much broader authority to protect the public interest. Second, as I mentioned, this Court and the Supreme Court have indicated that FERC has authority to take into account non-jurisdictional gas products or non-jurisdictional gas activities when it acts pursuant to Sections 4 and 5. And the example of that is the GRI funding proceeding, Public Utility Commission of the State of Colorado versus FERC, where FERC was able to take into account the GRI's activities and the funding for those activities pursuant to a Section 4 proceeding. And in addition,
that FERC's jurisdiction here, or at least their ability to impose conditions, is affected at all by the difference between, say, Columbia Gas, where there was a contractual relationship and they were actually selling to the end users, and this case where FGT says we're just transporting it.
I believe in that situation, FERC looked at the public interest duty as well, and we're asking FERC, we're asking this court to rule that FERC does have the duty despite there not being a contractual relationship. This gas, you know, what FGT is doing is changing the status quo on its system. This gas is being visited on us. There is no contractual relationship yet. We don't think, we think FERC has sufficient jurisdiction under its public interest duty to protect consumers. As I mentioned, FERC ignored the fact that it had consolidated, its third and final error was that it had consolidated two Natural Gas Act Section 7 proceedings with this proceeding. In reviewing Section 7 certificate applications, FERC is required to scrutinize all factors and is expected to impose those conditions that may be required to protect consumers. This court has repeatedly held that FERC has authority to condition the certificates of jurisdictional facilities that transport non-jurisdictional gas products.
If they condition this certificate, what would the condition be? In other words, how would they accomplish what it is that you want to do?
The condition would be that FERC would have to set up a mechanism for reviewing our costs and allocating them to those parties that are responsible for those costs.
So in your view, they could have a condition that's somewhat contingent that they decide later on what the actual cost is?
Sure. FERC did exactly that in a proceeding involving an LNG import terminal, Broadwater Energy. And what they did is they looked at the impact on fishermen, which is a public interest impact, and they said that prior to Broadwater moving forward, it has to file with the FERC documentation describing a mechanism for fishermen to file damaged gear claims and receive compensation. So we view that FERC has sufficient authority to review our retrofit costs and allocate those to the responsible parties.
Responsible party allocation is one of those things that you may be careful what you ask for because you might get it. Because lots of times, responsible party is determined to be the person buying the gas, aren't they?
We are not buying the gas in this situation, mm-hmm. So we would not be a responsible party.
What are you doing with the gas in this situation?
In this situation, the gas is being visited on us. It's moving into a system on which we are the largest shipper.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I just ask a practical question? Because I don't understand exactly how this works. You're buying the gas from someone, right? I mean, you need gas to run the turbines, correct?
Yes, we do. I see my time's up, but I'd like to answer your question.
As long as we're asking you questions.
we'll give you back your
respectful
time.
We may not give you as much as you want sometimes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
We purchase gas typically in the Gulf region and move that gas through the FGT system to our end-use facilities. Mm-hmm. This gas, the LNG, would be moving directly into the market area. Because gas is fungible, we have no control over what gas we actually burn and the quality of that gas.
You're buying a quantity of gas, and you're getting a quantity of gas.
Yes.
And what I'm suggesting is responsible party very often means the party who's buying the gas. Now, you may not have bought these particular molecules, but as you just admitted, they're not fungible. You're getting gas off the system.
Yes. And that issue is...
you're refining the term responsible party in a rather different way than we have often done. I won't suggest that it's distorting it, but we often look at the responsible party as being the person who caused gas to be shipped on the system.
Well, that issue is actually not before this court. We're asking...
You seem to be making it.
Yeah, it sounds
you're
like
asking us for a responsible party determination.
Like you just said, now that I think about it, let's take the issue off the table.
No.
The position doesn't sound consistent.
We had argued that there are several responsible parties for introducing this gas to the FGT system. It's the LNG import terminals. It's the shippers on the upstream systems. It's the upstream systems. It's FGT. There are several responsible parties that FERC could place these costs on.
One of whom might be the person purchasing the gas, because there's no purchaser, there's no gas ship.
Well, that would be fine with us.
So you would quit buying gas?
We are not buying LNG.
You're not buying gas?
We're buying
You're getting gas.
Getting
gas off the system.
Yes.
As you admitted, it's not the gas is fungible. You can't sort out your molecules. So each end user is responsible for gas being shipped on that system. One way to determine a responsible party is to say they're responsible for gasmanship and so we divide it among the end users. Instead, they're saying we don't have jurisdiction and costs are going to fall where they...
And we indeed argued on rehearing that one of the parties that could be responsible for these costs is the FGT system. And it could be allocated to end users. Our preference is obviously that the responsible parties upstream of the FGT system take on the cost burden.
Okay. I think we've exhausted that issue. I want to give you a minute now if you want to speak about the other issue.
Sure. I appreciate that.
2 minutes.
Our second issue was with respect to the fact that FERC, without substantial evidence, allowed FGT to move from the status quo to allow a broader quality range on its system, even with the recognition that it would impact FPLs.
Didn't they consult the manufacturer's documentation on the turbines and base that spread on that documentation?
That's exactly what they did.
How can we say that's not substantial evidence? You understand the standard is not...
Yes, I do understand. It's a single piece of evidence that they relied upon, and they misinterpreted that evidence.
Have you ever seen a case that said one piece is not enough to be substantial evidence?
No, but they did misinterpret that evidence. If you look at the four corners of the document, the G specifications specifically state that the plus or minus 5% range represents, it's a modified Wobbe index range, it represents a design operating range of the fuel nozzles. FERC deemed it to mean that it represents the variability range that these units can handle before retuning. And the specifications, well, they ignored the fact that the specifications actually state that once you tune within that plus or minus 5% design range, the variability the unit can handle before retuning is limited. Essentially, all parties agreed that testing is needed to determine the variability of these units before retuning. And FGT even indicated in proposing these standards that that's the critical question in this proceeding. FERC agreed that more testing is needed, but nevertheless moved forward. The only evidence that FERC has with regard to how our units will operate over a range that's two times broader than the historical range is
Go ahead. Tell me what the evidence was.
Is the manufacturer specifications, which don't tell you what that variability range is. Everyone agreed in the proceeding that testing is needed to determine that range. FERC relied on one piece of evidence, and
But FERC did rely on evidence.
It did, but
and the fact that it's one piece is not particularly material, is it, Jen?
As I've said, if you read page 11 of that document, it does not give the variability range of these units. FERC looked at the fact that there's a plus or minus 5% standard modified Wobbe index in the document, and indicated that means that the units can handle that range. Everyone in the docket agreed that...
We've used the 2 minutes that I allocated you back. We'll give you a couple back for rebuttal.
Thank you.
And we'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning. Carol Banta for the commission. I can begin with the last point that was discussed about the manufacturer's specifications. Both the ALJ and the commission thoroughly addressed all the evidence and all of the witness testimony. Certainly there were, all the witnesses agreed, as does the commission and the Natural Gas Council working group that set out the interim guidelines, that further testing is warranted. But the NGC, as well as the commission in its policy statement and here, said we do know enough to move forward with this range while continuing testing, the alternative being that we stop LNG completely until this testing is finished. So as a policy decision, the commission in the policy statement as well as this proceeding said, yes, let's do more testing, but we know enough right now. In addition, all of the witnesses in the testimony in the proceeding agreed that there were concerns about combustion dynamics beyond a certain range, but they're actually the specifications actually do say that and the witnesses that there is some range and it may be less than 5%, although the manufacturer's specifications say 5% of operational variability, but the commission didn't choose plus or minus 5%. It actually chose plus or minus 2% around a midpoint, and found based on credible witness testimony that that would be operationally, that would be safe and reliable and efficient. And that's why the commission and the ALJ rejected a broader range. The LNG suppliers wanted to follow the NGC, the Natural Gas Council Working Group interim guidelines that actually allow a plus or minus 4% range. And in this case, the commission said, well, because of the sensitivities of these particular kinds of turbines that, that operate in this market area, plus or minus 2% is more reasonable. And so actually limited it from what the policy statement chose to be the best guideline in general, which is the plus or minus 4%. I think that addresses the WOBE range.
You're on to the next issue.
Sure. With regard to the costs, I do want to note that the jurisdictional ruling was the commission's primary basis for declining cost allocation, but not the only one. The commission also said, we've looked at what these costs could be. We don't find them significant. We don't, if they were excessive, they might well make the gas interchangeability standards that we're choosing unjust and unreasonable. But the commission indicated it wouldn't allocate these costs even if it had jurisdiction to do so.
Let me ask you about that, because I understood in reading their decision, they said at one point, we agree with the ALJ that these costs are speculative and indefinite. Then they said, but they're nominal.
Right.
I don't know how they can be both.
Well, I think partly the commission, there are a couple answers to that. One is that they weren't just talking about these generators, turbines, which were exhaustively litigated in this proceeding. They were also talking about various other end user equipment. It's not just these turbines that'll be tested going forward. It's the local distribution company's equipment, et cetera. But the commission did look more at the testimony. It is speculative what any particular turbine owned by any particular company might need or not need. So the commission looked at what those costs might be. For instance, in their brief, Florida Power and Light says something about $32 million. That's if you assume that the potential $1 million total of all the things you could have to do applied to every single one of those turbines. And not only is there no evidence in the record to support that, there's actually evidence in the record to indicate that's not nearly what would be required for every single one. So the commission looked and said in some cases it's just retuning. In some cases it might be the fuel nozzles changing. Although I think if you look at the record, much of the concern about that was for the Siemens Westinghouse turbines, which are much more limited in their range and need to be retuned. Just to be clear, the record is quite clear, and I can point you to the pages if you want, that all of Florida Power and Light's turbines, Florida Power and Light being the only generator here on appeal, all of their turbines are GE. So to the extent these orders are talking about the special concerns for the Siemens Westinghouse, and if you read the ALJ's decision, it looks like the Siemens Westinghouse turbines actually drove the concern about narrowing the range to the plus or minus 2% because the GE ones might well have been more flexible. But now we're only talking about GE. We're not even talking about Siemens Westinghouse. I don't know if it came up in the argument, but the one argument that was made below was that also, these turbines were really designed for a much lower range. So if you want to run them to 1396, we're going to have problems with that. And the commission said, well, the evidence to that is really not credible and not reliable. But even if it were true, it would be a self-imposed constraint. If you designed a turbine to operate in a range significantly lower than what the historical range has been, if you did that, it makes no sense. But in any event, that's no basis for setting the standards for the entire system. And if there are costs involved with changing that, that was a business decision that someone made to buy a turbine that wasn't appropriate for the system. So we wouldn't allocate those costs either. So the commission said they are speculative, but we know what kinds of costs we're looking at, and we just don't find them to be that significant.
You did say that apparently their primary reason for this was jurisdictional.
Yes.
So let's talk about that.
Sure. I do want to note one thing. This does go to the jurisdiction as well. Given that what was before the commission was the transportation tariff of Florida Gas, by adding these gas quality and interchangeability standards, it does impose costs and requirements on the upstream suppliers, because it tells Florida Gas that if this upstream supplier, LNG or otherwise, doesn't meet these standards, you can shut in their gas and not transport it. So to the extent that the upstream suppliers, be they LNG or an intermediate pipeline or whoever it might be, if their gas can't meet these standards, then they're going to have to take on costs of processing. So the commission said that by imposing this plus or minus 2%, which is a very narrow range and narrower than the policy statement has endorsed, we are indirectly imposing costs and not just incentivizing, but maybe forcing upstream suppliers to take on processing costs. So the commission considered that part of this calculus of mitigation as well, that there are costs already being imposed on the responsible parties in that regard. To address a few things that Petitioner's Counsel said in particular, the Opinion 101 Columbia Cove Point, the commission thoroughly addressed that. That's a early 1980s case that involved bundled sales. We're in the world of unbundling where we're dealing with transportation. So, of course, there, the pipeline was taking on costs that avoided other jurisdictional costs. And the commission said it's reasonable to make all of the jurisdictional sales customers shoulder that burden because it's saving jurisdictional costs. So here you would have to have the nexus to the actual transportation charges. And the commission said, well, what we're doing with these quality standards, indirectly imposing costs on the upstream parties, is pretty much the most we can do with this jurisdictional hook. There's just not enough of a nexus.
And they're talking about their Section 5
right.
hook, right?
Right.
Let me ask you about Section 7,
mm-hmm.
because that was one that council also identified as a possible basis for conditioning, I guess, the certificate to allow them to construct these facilities. And it seems that the commission, there's a 1999 policy statement
mm-hmm.
Where they talk about this, and they say when we're determining whether we're going to permit the construction of this, we look at whether the benefits outweigh the adverse effects on economic interest. And says specifically, we will look at, do I need to identify that more?
Actually, I don't believe I have the certificate policy statement with me.
Well, in general,
right.
What it seems to say to me is that we'll look at adverse effects on the pipeline and its captive customers,
mm-hmm.
which I assume would include end users. So I guess my question is, if FERC says, in fact, we look at that, but then says, but we don't have jurisdiction, you know, how do you reconcile that?
I think it is something that goes into the public interest. I don't have the exact site for you. I know the commission said, here the argument we don't think really is the public interest so much as the generator's own interests, but that's a side point. The commission would look at that in the certification, but the actual kind of cost out, this is where the commission talked about the American Gas Association case, and there are limits to what the commission can really do, and this just goes beyond. You know, we can impose these gas quality standards, and that does have a financial effect on.
I understand the Section 5 argument, and I understand.
Well, but the commission made the same point in the Section 7.
As far as we can go under Section 5. But let me read this language to you specifically. Basically, they say, depending on the type of project, there are three major interests that may be adversely affected by approval of major certificate projects, and that must be considered by the commission. There are, the interests of the applicant's existing customers, the interests of competing existing pipelines and their captive customers, and the interests of landowners and surrounding communities.
Right.
Okay.
The point that I made, the commission actually made in discussing Section 7 in the rehearing order, which is why I was conflating those around paragraphs 100, 101 in the rehearing order, where the commission talked about American Gas Association. And the commission has chosen to impose, for instance, in the AES, well, that was the complaint proceeding.
What's the JA page on
this? Oh, I'm sorry, JA 86.
Okay, thank you.
And actually, I think it starts on JA 85.
Okay.
But this is where the commission was talking about Section 7. And it said with the certificates in the Southern and the FG, the Florida gas facilities that had to be constructed upstream to deal with some of this LNG, that what the commission decided there was that the public interest would be served by instituting gas quality and interchangeability standards and forcing compliance with those. So that's how the commission has chosen
to proceed. Did we not say in AGA, in the commission quotes, the commission may not use its Section 7 conditioning power to do indirectly
what it can't do directly.
On things that it can only be done by satisfying specific safeguards not contained in Section 7E.
Right. And moving on to paragraph 103 on the next page, JA87, the commission continues to find that its Section 7 authority to condition the certificates does not give it the authority to go further and order LNG terminals to process gas or reallocate end user mitigation costs. So this is the commission saying, yeah, we have a little bit of leeway, but we'd really be stretching the nexus, and I probably would be standing in front of you facing an appeal from some other party about how we've gone completely off.
Given that whatever the commission does, it's likely to have a petition for review coming up.
That's true as well.
If you make everybody happy, you've not finished yet.
Exactly. Well, and that's what the commission was saying in this case. We have to balance the interest in LNG supply. And again, the LNG suppliers, BG, a shipper, were urging broader standards. The generators were urging narrower standards. And the commission said
this. What do you think of that line of inquiry?
It's interesting how you prioritized your argument.
Yeah, we want to get to the other.
I know, yes.
Maybe it's because you don't have an answer, which I would understand.
Oh, I do.
Market standards to Western Division Gas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was starting with what was fresh on everyone's minds, but I
what was fresher in my mind.
I knew you were waiting. Okay. I would note that this isn't just about LNG. The commission said, the ALJ had said this will just apply, these standards apply to LNG, and the commission said no, they're going to apply to domestic as well, and within the market area, no one contested that. So we're talking about all the gas having to fit within this range, which makes sense because it's commingled, it's blended, the particles aren't separated out, as you said. The commission said, here we have a concern on the part of these generators who have these special turbines that are sensitive to variability, that we need a WOBE range, and there were a number of other gas quality issues that aren't on appeal, sulfur, non-methane. I don't really know as much about that stuff because it wasn't an issue on appeal. But all of these standards matter to the end users, which in this particular market, 80% of Florida Gas's throughput goes to gas-fired generators. And I forget what percentage of those generators are these sensitive, lower emission types, but a substantial amount, as you can see from the litigation here. If we had a rule where third parties that put gas onto the Florida gas pipeline or suppliers that ship right into the market area and join the Florida gas pipeline there have to meet these standards, but Florida gas can bring anything from the Western Division, it would be discriminatory. Different.
They found that there was no problem.
Yeah.
From the Western Division, yeah. There had been none. There still was none.
But there is a problem in the market area.
You're adopting a rule for LNG is because they're bringing in something that's problematic.
There's LNG in the Western Division as well, just not as much,
well,
and it gets blended
more. Exactly the same gas, yeah, in the Western Division as in the market area,
right,
isn't it?
Right.
You're testing it at an arbitrary line at the Florida border.
Actually, no. The commission did not say how you have to do this. And the commission was very clear. We're not telling you.
But there are two questions. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you do it, but quite apart from that, why? They said there's no problem.
Because in the market area, everything needs
to fit. No problem in the market area either. They've been coming into the market area.
Well, there isn't a problem with the domestic gas in the market area either, but the commission said all this gas gets blended together, and it has to.
They're not here.
Because no one objected to that.
Well,
because,
that
the commission said it would be discriminatory to have a different standard.
Now, that doesn't mean that the Western Division doesn't have a viable objection because others haven't. They're in a different situation. There's no problem. They're saying there's no problem here, and the commission found that there's no problem.
That there hasn't been, right. But
there is none.
But this, we're only talking about the Western Division gas that's imported into the market area.
That's right. That's right.
And it's the same
and
gas.
If it doesn't have
same
to.
Same gas in the commission starts. I'm reading this. I'm saying, wow, how did you. I had to read it 12 times because I couldn't figure out how you possibly could get to that result with the precedent statements that there's no problem.
Because if there's no standard for it at all, There will be more LNG coming into the Western Division. No one will have any way to measure it, and you'll have discriminatory standards that apply.
Is there not testing that goes on at receipt points now?
I don't know about these standards, but the commission said, look, it's just if you want to...
Unless I'm missing something. You can't make this change unless they've identified a problem.
But the change is only to the market area tariff.
You can't make the Western Division, you can't change their structure unless you've identified a problem in the five. What's the problem?
This is section.
The problem under section five, the problem, let me back up. The problem that the commission was addressing in setting standards on the market area transportation tariff wasn't because there had been a problem. It was because there could be a problem in the future, and the commission said the problem is that
I don't even understand what the could be a problem in the future is.
LNG.
I don't get it from the commission's opinion.
There's the commission had found in the complaint order, yeah. I think, that the problem is that the tariff currently doesn't have interchangeability standards. And everyone knows there's going to be more LNG. So this tariff needs to have interchangeability standards. The generators need it because they're 80% of the users.
But these standards are not needed in the Western Division?
And they have not been applied to transportation in the Western Division. They've only been applied
to
gas.
Why would the same problem not occur in the Western Division? Now, presumably, there are some turbines
there. Well, the commission, I spoke incorrectly. The commission initially said, we'll look at the Western Division, too. But when it came after the proceeding, after the hearing, and on the orders here, the commission said, we don't have enough of a record to conclude whether there's a problem with transportation, gas transported in the Western Division.
The commission explained that the record developed at the hearing in this proceeding was insufficient to support a finding under NGA Section 5 that the current gas standards applicable to the Western Division are unjust and unreasonable.
Right. Exactly. Applicable
Once
to the Western Division.
Once they have said that, how can they do anything under Section 5?
Because we're not changing the Western Division transportation tariff at all. We're not touching it. That's the point. There is transportation going on.
Same gas.
But it's not the same transportation, the same tariff, the same end users, the same market area, or the same concerns.
How is there any difference in any of those things? Now, granted, there may be a different mix of end users, but are you seriously going to tell me there are no gas turbines in the Western Division? And if there are, where did the commission rely on that fact?
But they weren't litigating here.
From the same place to the same place that it was going before, and the commission said there were no problems. None.
But there hadn't been
problems. And there aren't any now that they've identified. Other than, but we've regulated these other folks with respect to whom there is a problem.
Not folks, so, we've regulated the market area tariff, the transportation tariff, and now we're going to set up different standards for different
I'll tell you what,
gas.
It doesn't. An agency has got to do a better job in explaining the issue, if there is an issue, than they did here, because... Mm-hmm.
It's not, the issue isn't that there's been a problem with the gas. The issue is that...
If it's not, then how can you go under Section 5? If there's not been any problem...
Because it is a problem going forward, which is why it's Section...
They haven't identified a problem.
The transportation in the Florida gas system needs to have this interchangeability standard.
Why does it need more standards in the market area than it has in the Western Division?
Because they didn't say how they had to do it, but nonetheless,
they've drawn a line at the border of Florida.
Where does the commission say why?
It says in the...
Not what you think.
What started all of this is that the concern of the generators in the market area, that they were going to get more widely varying gas. And so whatever generators there, maybe they don't have the same emission standards in Alabama that they have in Florida. The generators
maybe,
in the Western Division
maybe going to get you anywhere.
Hmm?
Maybe. Is maybe going to get you anywhere.
Well, what I'm saying is that we don't have a record to change the standards in the Western Division because nobody was litigating it. But we didn't change the interchangeability standards for transportation in the Western Division. We said when you take gas that was there and bring it here.
Hold it. Don't talk while we're interrupting you, please.
Of course.
What's the best statement you have from the commission in the record of what it is that's broke that they're fixing by this order?
I'm not sure I flagged that because it's at the beginning, which is why we're changing the market area, and no one was really contesting that.
We can't
that,
find it either.
We haven't found it. We understand you represent a...
Because it's not there.
You represent a government agency.
No,
and you're not permitted to confess error.
No, it. I think it was when we set it for hearing to begin with. In the JA 197, in paragraph 27 and 28, 28 in particular, the commission will exercise its authority under Section 5 of the NGA and direct Florida Gas to file tariff revisions related to gas quality and interchangeability standards, and this was in the market area. And that's
what paragraph are you in there?
Paragraph 28 on JA 197. This is what led to the hearing where we had all the witnesses and the stuff about the turbines and everything about...
This is the warm-up. Now, where are the findings?
Where is a finding that supports
that's
this?
That's just the commission saying, okay, we want to get involved in this. Okay, fine. You're involved in this. Now, where are their findings to support what they did? The only findings they have go counter to what they did. You're not going to find them. They're not there. And we respect you for that. You're doing the best you can, but they're not there.
I believe they are because, I mean...
No, counsel, there's no way you could prepare
well,
for this case.
Actually,
assuming you talked with your colleagues, you read the commission. They're not there. And I laugh sitting here saying, she's waiting till the end. Maybe we'll go away.
No.
And we won't raise this issue.
Not without a fight.
It's not there.
No, the burden, if you look at the burden of proof argument, which of course was not something that's litigated here, but the commission had to address whether when Florida Gas made its tariff filing to institute, which then led to the hearing. They made their tariff filing with the interchangeability standards. It was protested. It goes before the ALJ, and we have a hearing. There was an argument about whether they made their filing under Section 4 or Section 5, and the commission had to address that. And the commission said, here, Florida Gas recognized that there was a problem and made its filing under Section 5. It agreed that there was a problem, and that's why the commission gave some deference to the burden turned out not to be dispositive, which is why I think it hasn't been litigated. But there is that discussion in paragraphs, starting at JA7 to JA9, and it may have come up again in the rehearing order because I think someone did contest. Yeah, at JA68 and 69. And the commission talks about how this tariff filing that we've then litigated came about. And it was Florida Gas accepting that there was a Section 5 problem and making its Section 5 proposal for what...
What are you saying is the commission said, oh, there's things to consider, that's all. These are not findings that you're talking about.
There is a finding that...
Well,
you
haven't found it yet. We've been all sitting here wondering. Yeah. We're looking down like, where is she at now?
Because it came before...
Where is it?
Right.
It's not there.
Paragraph 6 on 68, and that is a recitation of what we're up to. It isn't a finding.
There's just no finding of a problem. If there is a problem, it's the agency's responsibility to lay it out.
Except that
it's
because
a major issue, and it's counsel's responsibility to come in knowing it's a major issue to say, here's what the agency found. You can't do what you're supposed to do because they didn't do what they were supposed to.
Well, I think the problem from your perspective is that
it's your problem.
No, I know. The problem is that it precedes this. The only orders on appeal are what happened in the litigation of which Section 5 remedy to apply. The Section 5 problem preceded all this and actually is in not in the orders on appeal.
It doesn't unless they identify it for us.
Except that
we can't surmise that there is a Section 5.
But it's not on appeal before you because the litigation here and the only orders before the court are premised on there having been a Section 5.
Now, there's not anything unjust and unreasonable in the Western Division, which is less before them than the market area. If
that's
anything.
Like
well, again, I have
to be concerned if they regulated something in Texas, which they identified.
Well, and that's why I have to distinguish that we did not change the tariff in the Western Division. We said if you have gas that was previously in the Western Division, gas that was previously in Georgia, gas that was previously in Bermuda, wherever it was, if it's coming into the market area and being transported under the market area tariff,
if
these standards apply.
If there was a restraint point at the market area line, that might work, or might not, but it might work. But there isn't. This is the same pipeline, same gas, same everything,
right,
except for the arbitrary line at the state line of of Florida.
Well, the arbitrary line is the tariff under which it's being transported, but the commission said we're not.
That doesn't keep it from being an arbitrary choice with respect to the.
Well, but the key, and the commission emphasizes this in the orders, isn't where it's received, it's where it's delivered to these generators, who are then going to have to worry about combustion dynamics if there's a variation that no one knew about because it didn't have to comply with the standard.
They've already preceded that by saying there is no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no standard applied. And this whole proceeding was on the Section 5 need.
They've delivered pursuant to standards before.
What's that?
They have existing standards, and there are no problems.
They don't have an interchangeability standard. They just happen to have met in the past. As more LNG ships into Alabama, if there are no standards for what gets shipped into Florida, these generators could get anything. I mean, at least, you know, with the commission not having imposed it.
Okay. We'll hear from the first petitioner first in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you had, first petitioner had time left.
Yes, 3 minutes.
All right. Rebuttal.
Your Honor, I think the court understands our issue.
All right.
So unless there are any further questions.
Seeing none, we'll thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your time was up, but we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The case we present on cost allocation in the FERC's authority has significant consequence for the industry, because FERC has claimed that it not only in this proceeding lacks authority, but in any future FGD proceeding it lacks authority, as well as in any other proceeding where the issue has been addressed at FERC involving the introduction of LNG. It has refused to address the issue. It says it lacks authority. So it has significance beyond this proceeding. The solicitor has cited to the AGA opinion and claimed that it gives FERC some authority to not address the issue. What AGA held was that because FERC was trying to affect the wellhead price of gas in AGA, and the D.C. Circuit said you can't do...
We said in Section 7 does not create independent power to override the lack of a congressional grant of authority.
Exactly. And what we're...
That's sort of parallel to this, doesn't it?
It is very parallel to this, and we think that you're correct in that interpretation. Contrary,
if it's parallel to this, how can you win?
No, I can win because we're not asking you to rule on the price or the terms of the purchase and sale of LNG. You are asking us to
read power into FERC's power grants through Section 7 that isn't otherwise there, aren't you?
No, our view is that this proceeding was brought under Natural Gas Act Sections 5 and 7 and involves the interconnection of LNG to jurisdictional transportation systems and the jurisdictional movement of that gas to our end-use facilities. Of course, FERC has jurisdiction over the transport and the sale for resource sale of natural gas. Section 1B specifically gives FERC natural gas jurisdiction over transportation and sale and sale for resale of natural gas. You know, otherwise, FERC's order, taken to its logical conclusion, could be read to conclude that FERC loses its authority to protect the public interest any time that first sale gas is being moved into interstate commerce. We think that's wrong. That logic would be inconsistent with this court's ruling in Henry versus Federal Power Commission, where, despite a recognition that FERC has no authority over synthetic gas, this court nevertheless said that FERC has authority to impose conditions on the transportation of that gas.
Go beyond your rebuttal time, so unless my colleagues have further questions, seeing none, the case is submitted.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
I Or a vacuum cleaner, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you glue it?
Yeah, I can just shatter it. It's never going to fit in there perfectly, but it's at least it's kind of subtle, even if you look at it like this. Marilyn, the other day we were talking, Betsy sent that email out about Marshall's request for things like blocks, carburetors, and all that.
And yeah, I had a question. I wasn't sure what you were talking about.
Yeah, understood.
I knew you were talking about here, but I wasn't sure what else.
Yeah, and this gets a little bit tricky because I'm not sure the Marshalls have picked this out correctly. You know, I think they're thinking, and I'm going to confirm this, in terms of district court courtrooms, which are set up differently from this, where, you know, you have that back door that goes out into the restricted hallway. So if we're lucky, they've at least picked that up. But that won't address this or this that also go back there.
Right.
But these doors aren't even set up to receive those because these
are
just swinging doors.
No, no, but this door.
Yeah, go ahead.
This door here, as far as I'm concerned, can just stay unlocked, you know, both ways. You know, this one, because, you know, there's a door right here.
Yes.
So I assumed that one of the things that we're talking about was that door.
They were talking about in district court courtrooms, the door.
No, but they said 3 days. I mean, three doors. So I thought they meant that door.
I said three doors.
But you meant this one, and the one over there?
I meant that one. Only in the courtroom, not in the
okay, but I don't see any reason that should have carpet.
No. Actually, before I go, I wanted to talk to you guys before I went back to the Marshalls for clarification on what they really planned in here. Because, again, this is a different setup, and I don't think they investigated it that closely. I mean, to me, you know, if we have these open, somebody can still just walk through here. This, I don't know why this would not be locked almost all the time.
In case of maybe an emergency where the judges have
to...
Rogers comes through there.
Okay.
She comes through here?
Okay,
also, though, if someone started shooting, they're going to go the fastest way out.
Sure, understood.
You know, now they don't have to necessarily go out there, but at least they can then...
They're back behind the stone and everything else in that danger. Okay.
Yeah, I would not leave that locked.
Well, in the...
And you don't... want to lock that? Are you saying to lock that?
In the annex, they're all automatic locks.
Automatic, right.
Yes, carpenter.
That's right. Remember when we used to court to do that?
Yeah. So
that was like
Yes. Well, you know what? The district court judges are asking to have it added onto these courtrooms over here. So that's what I wanted to get at hold of you guys for. We need to...
I would mind to have a card reader.
The only thing about a card reader, too, is I think, let's see, yeah, we can do a mag lock back there. We would have to do a magnetic lock instead of an electric strike because that door swings both ways, and it would be the lock that would be holding it closed. Now, you know what? That would be a problem, though, because you know how the mag locks work. There would be a piece hanging from the frame down here and a piece on the door holding it tight. As soon as it swings into it the first time, it's going to knock it loose. Well, I'll work it out. But I mean, this might even require a different door installed there.
Well, and for historical reasons.
Yeah. Anyways, that was going to be a challenge.
And if it's an emergency, what if the judge has a card reader or whatever?
What do they do in the annex if there's an emergency? Duck?
Actually, literally, yes.
And I think they're supposed to duck underneath the bench, right? Because there's Kevlar there, right? But we don't have that.
Well, we are just way behind. I was feeling so good after that conversation about the lectern. Now this.
Oh, I know.
We're state-of-the-art with our lectern, but everything else is way behind. The district court courtrooms in this building, they actually laminated the material onto the interior side here, which, by the way, looks terrible. In the annex, of course, that's built into the millwork. So those benches are the least.
I could see our judges ducking under. I could see them ducking. I mean, seriously, if someone starts shooting,
Bullet will go right through here, though. I mean, it'll screen you, but it'll go right through here.
I can see shooting back.
Just tell.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he must have his gun with him.
Oh, good God. Because he'd probably hit everybody with the first name he's aiming for. First shot would be Victor, second shot would be Shayna, a couple people in the audience. But
okay, so let's just talk locks right now.
Yes. So we definitely want that on a card reader.
matrix string, right? So that instead of having to use a key,
right,
you can use a bat. You'll be able to use either one, I should say.